Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Finally, this hour, the funeral for General John Vesey will be a week from Wednesday at the chapel at Fort Snelling. He'll be buried the next day at the Veterans Cemetery in Camp Riley. Vesey died last week in North Oaks, Minnesota at the age of 94. After lying about his age to join the Minnesota National Guard in 1939, Vesey fought in World War II in Vietnam, rising through the ranks the entire time, eventually to become President Ronald Reagan's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's the president's top-ranking military advisor. He then retired back to Minnesota in 1985, but only kind of. We found in the NPR archives this interview from 1997 that Vesey did with Rachel Reeby, whom Vesey told he was ready to retire in 1981 when that call came from the new Reagan White House.
I was in Punta del Este on the eastern tip of Uruguay on a Saturday afternoon. And I got a message saying the Secretary of Defense wants you to call him at the White House immediately. And I thought, oof-da, what? What is that?
Now that was a Minnesota reaction.
Right. So I finally got into a phone booth in Punta del Este and got a hold of Mr. Weinberger. And he said, can you talk secure, meaning can you talk on a scrambled system? And I said, no, I'm in Punta del Este. And, we got back late Sunday, in fact, early Monday morning. He told me to come in at 8 o'clock in the morning. I finally was ushered into the office, and Mr. Weinberger was putting on his coat, and he said, come on, we have an appointment with the president in 5 minutes. And we got in the elevator on the way down to his car, and he said, the president wants to settle this business of who's to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he said, you're fairly high on a short list. So I said, whoa. I said, I can't go over there. I said, my retirement papers are in. I promised my wife that we'll be in Minnesota this summer. We're building a new house. I have a 19% construction loan from the bank in Brainerd, and it's a suction pump in my bank account. Of course, that was when interest rates were astronomical. And he said, well, you'll just have to tell that to the president. And was left alone with him for about an hour, and we talked military strategy, national strategy, what to do about the Soviet Union, arms control, and a whole bunch of other things. So I went through my little speech with the president about my promises to Avis and my house problems. And he said, you go talk to her. So I went over to Fort McNair, where the vice chief lived, and Avis was working in the flower garden. And I told her what had happened, and a tear came down her cheek, and I put my arms around her, and I said, how do we get into things like this? And she said, you lied about your age to get into the National Guard, and God is punishing you.
Was it a long discussion with her? Did you turn it over and over? Or when the invitation was extended, did you know that you had to take it?
Well, that's what Ava said. You have to take it. I knew a lot about the armed forces and a lot about national strategy and building defense budgets and things like that, but there are a whole bunch of things that only the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff does that I knew only intellectually.
The major challenge in that job during your time under Reagan was what?
Well, that was the denouement of the Cold War. It was the Soviet Union was making its what turned out to be its last major effort to roll NATO over. It included times when the Soviets were dabbling in the political process in Europe, certainly in the elections in Germany and in the Netherlands, deploying their SS-20 intermediate range nuclear missiles, sponsoring lot of trouble through Castro and Central and Latin America, and most importantly, adding more intercontinental ballistic missile warheads to their arsenal each year than we had in our arsenal. And the question was, were we going to answer the challenge? And we did. NATO hung together through tremendous effort, making it clear that we would not be on the losing side.
What kind of a commander-in-chief was President Reagan?
Well, from the armed forces point of view, he was a good commander. One of the things that we did is we met regularly with him, which was different from other presidents, different from Carter, Ford, or Nixon that I know of. And it was one of the things that I suggested to President Reagan. I told him that you can. I don't know where past presidents have all gotten their military advice, and you can get it from any place. You can get it by reading Beadle Bailey if you want to. But the law says that your principal military advisors are the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I suggest to you that you meet regularly with the Joint Chiefs. Now the president. Every president meets with the chairman quite regularly because the chairman sits in on the National Security Council meetings. But it's not often that presidents in the past met regularly with the Joint Chiefs as a body. And the other thing that made him an effective commander-in-chief is that he could delegate. He didn't dabble in the details, and perhaps some will point to some of the things that happened during the Reagan administration and say, well, that was a weakness. And certainly there were some details that some of the Iran-Contra things that he'd have been better off if he'd have dabbled in the details a little more. But just to cite his ability to delegate, the night before the Grenada operation, we were convoked to the White House. It was early in the evening. The military leaders weren't pushing for the invasion of Grenada. It was an issue where American lives at stake or thought to be at stake and the students that were there. And we told the president what we could do. We would like to have had time to rehearse it, to make sure it was as smooth as possible, but we didn't have time. We had only about 48 hours to prepare the plans for the operation. So the president said, all right, go ahead. General, what are you going to do? I said, Mr. President, I'm going home and go to bed. I said, you've approved a plan that we and the Joint Chiefs have looked at, and we think it is probably the best plan we could construct in the time available. We have competent commanders who are ready to carry it out, and there's not much I can do between now and the time that the troops land. So I'm going home and go to bed and come in probably about 2 hours after the first part of the operation has taken place and find out what's happened. The president said, that sounds like a good idea. He said, I'm going to go to bed, too. Why don't you call me after you find out what happened and let me know?
Those 3 years, were you almost living at the White House? Was it a very intense day and night kind of experience?
It's a small part of the day. The rest of the day is spent with the the hard parts, how to stick 10 pounds of defense into a 5-pound budget bag, which is the real challenge for military leaders always and always has been. It's a 24-hour-a-day job. I think the first night we were back here in Minnesota, Ava said, the next morning, do you realize that this is probably the first night in the last 3 years that you haven't had a telephone call between midnight and 6 o'clock in the morning. So it's full-time work.
That is General John Vesey in a 1997 interview with NPR's Rachel Reiby. After Vesey left that Joint Chiefs job, he tried to go back to being retired, but to no avail. Another call came when he was asked to start negotiations with the Vietnamese government to account for soldiers who were killed and still missing in Vietnam after the war there. It was supposed to be just a few months' work, but it stretched on for 6 years.
Are you satisfied after those 6.5 years of discussing prisoners of war and missing in action that the accounting is taken care of, that there are no more Americans in Vietnam?
Today, I think the number is about 90% of the cases that we thought had much of any chance of being alive have all been investigated and have been resolved, and the people are not alive. So I don't think you can ever answer the question categorically. There are no live Americans from the war in Vietnam. It's just not, it's not possible to prove a negative. But I think that one thing you can say is that we have investigated the cases of the people that we thought had the best chance of being alive, and all the evidence points to their being dead. And that work continues to go on. That's the one important thing, pledge we got from the Vietnamese, that we would continue to do that work. So that work continues to go on.
Do you think they are surprised, the Vietnamese, about our determination, some would call it an obsession?
They look out at 300,000 people missing, and they're wonder about our dedication to finding 2,000 missing. But they continue to cooperate, whether they understand it or not. I think that culturally it's not easy for them to understand our determination to resolve this issue.
That's a 1997 interview with General John Vesey, the Minnesota native who became President Reagan's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Vesey died last week in North Oaks, Minnesota. His funeral will be a week from Wednesday at Fort Snelling. And one final note, Rachel Reiby, who did that interview in 97, is now a Crow Wing County Commissioner.